And welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz, staying chill here in the control seat.
Well, it's pretty easy to stay chill these days.
So we haven't had a weather joke in a long time. I thought today was the day. Ugh. Mr. Freeze.
That's me. All right, there you go. There's your weather humor, because it's Canada. It's Open Sources, a CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show. You can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Just go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. And you can listen to us anytime by downloading Open Sources podcast from Podbean on the Guelph Politicast channel. Today we will look at affordable housing strategies here in Guelph. It's a policy that's currently being developed at City Hall. There are a pair of workshops open to the public on Tuesday to get feedback about what's being done so far and where the policy should go next. But should we really be talking about accessible housing? And then, Justin Trudeau announced this week the new strategy to fight ISIS in Iraq and Syria for Canada. And while it does involve withdrawing fighters in the next couple of weeks, it also involves an expansion of Canada's involvement in ground training and supporting the anti-ISIS troops. We will talk to someone who knows firsthand about fighting ISIS on the ground, a Canadian Forces veteran named Robert Somerville, and we'll get his perspective. And then finally, we will touch on what happened in New Hampshire and the latest doings in the U.S. presidential race. But first, and I swore we would never talk about this, but they just dared us this week. They dared us.
Yes.
The assault trial of former CBC host Jean Chrétien wrapped up today. The judge said he will be bringing his verdict down on March the 24th. And it does seem unlikely that Chrétien will see the inside of a prison cell. Fortunately, unfortunately, depending on your point of view, probably more to the latter. But if the trial did anything, Scotty, it may be making it more difficult in the future for women to come forward, especially if the person that assaulted them has some degree of infamy.
Well, that's exactly it. One of the comments I had read was that if it wasn't a celebrity, Jean Chrétien or whoever, pick the person, maybe even Bill Cosby, that this trial probably wouldn't have gotten the attention that it did, and it probably would have ended much sooner.
Although it did end pretty soon.
It did. Well, I got the impression that they were going to go to next week, but it looks like it's going to, it's wrapped up and the sentencing is in March, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Just to review in terms of sentencing, he was officially charged with four counts of sexual assault and one count of a kind of obscure charge, which is overcome resistance by choking. Now, as an add-on, it can actually lead to life in prison. So potentially, and it's unlikely, as all analysis says, that he's going to get life in prison. My guess would probably be some kind of probation counseling or whatever. But sad to say that it's not going to go that way in terms of a conviction because, according to stats from the YWCA, which have been widely quoted, that for every 1,000 assaults of varying degrees, which is the blanket sexual assault, 997 people walk away. And of the convictions, you know, it's not even jail time. So that's huge. So this is the atmosphere that we're dealing with. The only positive I can see out of this is that it has brought it to the fore and that it's being openly discussed as opposed to something that's in the back pages. Toronto Star had a whole section. I've never seen the like of a whole section on a trial. Hmm. They consider it to be that high profile, which it is. And so that's possibly the only plus to come out of this.
Yeah, but at the same time, I'm wondering if it's high profile because they want to take the idea of assault and standing up for women who have been assaulted seriously, or if it's just because it's a celebrity trial and there actually aren't too many of those in Canada.
That's true. Yeah, and that gets eyes on the page and on the TV.
Right. I mean, I do sometimes, unfortunately, catch like the opening seconds of E-Talk while I'm trying to change the channel after the 6 o'clock news.
Is it on there now?
That's the top story every freaking night. And it's I have to wonder about when a newspaper, a venerable newspaper like the Toronto Star, dedicates that kind of page count to something that's the top story on E-Talk for weeks running. They're two very different mm-hmm. news organizations, quote unquote news organizations, in the case of eTalk. And yeah, it just. As much as I think it's worth, I mean, in the newspapers there has been some good commentary about what the coverage has been like and what's been said in court and how the accusers have been cross-examined by the defense attorney. Mm-hmm. At the same time, though, the Toronto Star went to court to try and lift the publication ban on a picture of the first accuser whose identity isn't released. There's a publication ban. To get a photo of her, the bikini shot she's apparently mm-hmm. sent to Gomeshi after he assaulted her. They were going to blur out her face, but here's the Toronto Star squandering resources in court trying to get a picture of an alleged assault victim in a bikini.
Yeah, that seems unlike them for some reason, but you know they're really rolling with this, let's say. But... You know, I guess technically if it's out there and on the record, they probably should have access to it regardless of how, salacious it is or whatever. And it's unfortunate that it's, if that's the case, that it's taking a turn that way. But like you say, it is a celebrity trial. We can't really get around that. And of course, I'm of the mind, you have to believe the women. This is just in my view. The defense, oh my goodness, the defense just picking everything apart. And that's where it's been, I wouldn't say unfortunate, but it's just, there's been some commentary on that too. It's like, you know, nobody is a perfect witness. And in fact, it was, I think Christy Blatchford in the Post is like, she said, oh, these women have absolutely no credibility. And
Barbara Kay too.
Yeah. So, but I expect nothing less of the Post. But no, well, seriously, it's like that's the direction I'll take. And it's like, oh, they're just saying this, blah blah blah. But what's been left out from this that I remember when this first went down? Let's think back to why Gomeshi actually lost his job at the CBC. Mm-hmm. It wasn't directly because of these charges. There was the infamous now infamous Facebook letter. yeah. Right, prompted yeah. by Jesse Brown, right?
Right.
Or at least he was anticipating what Jesse Brown was going to reveal the next day. But not only that, he went to the executives of the CBC to sort of tell his story and had been using his phone for God knows what. It sounds like some sort of sexting to some degree. I don't know what was going on, but he actually showed it to them.
Yeah.
And then he showed up with a film of some kind saying, no, look at this. You know, this. I kind of like it rough. Here's a movie of me. And I'm sure anybody, let alone CBC executives, sitting looking at this is like, whoa, there's something wrong here. There's something terribly wrong with this situation. You've violated all sorts of corporate practices with our institution. Get out. That's why he lost his job.
Yeah.
On top of all these other charges as well. It just snowballed from there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's highly unlikely he'll ever, ever work in this country again in media. I don't know what he's going to do. It doesn't matter to me what he's going to do. But, that part of it is over for him. He's a persona non grata. But, you know.
It is interesting sort of seeing him go in and out of court. He does seem like an entirely different person now, just in terms of how he carries himself.
And I was trying to figure out what had changed. He shaved. I didn't recognize the picture of him at first. I saw him at a distance. Like, who's that? Looks like. I was like, oh, it's going. He's shaved.
And his hair doesn't have, like, the bounce on it. Like, he had that, like, that.
We're beginning to sound like a couple of eTalk people. Like, his hair was just dreadful. But, no, this is the thing they focus on.
His hair was dreadful, but he's different.
No,
but,
it's the walk. It's the walk in and the walk out, and he's got the look on his face, and you think, man, he looks like he's under the gun, because he is under the gun.
Yeah.
I'm kind of glad the smugness is gone. I got an anecdote about the guy. I'm one of those people. When this all first came out, I said, never liked the guy, never liked his band, which has nothing to do with it. But it sort of does, because I lived across from the Bloor cinema when Moxie Fruits were sort of coming up in their heyday, and we used to busk there, and I sort of had it out with them and Gomeshi in particular. I know this really has nothing to do with the trial or anything. It may seem like a minor point, but I thought he was a real jerk then. He was like, this is our space, you can't be here. I was like, I live across the street, dude. You know, I'm busking for pizza money, right? So anyway. So I had an encounter that's like 25 years ago. I thought, this guy's a real jerk. So obviously it hasn't changed too much. To varying degrees, to a horrible degree, by the sounds of it.
I had a Gomeshi.
Oh, here we go. I might as well tell both the anecdotes.
Yeah. Yeah. During my ill-advised tenure as a music journalist, I was in the press room of the Canadian Music Week Awards, and Lights won. Lights was the young woman he managed.
He was a handler. Yeah, yeah.
That's right. And so she comes back in the press room, and you had to kind of get his blessing before you could scrum with her. I mean, it was basically a scrum. It wasn't like, talk to you. And Gina's like, yes, I give you my blessing to ask my protege some questions about how it feels to be a winner. And there was a smell on the guy. Hindsight is 20/20. Anyway, back to the trial.
Yes. Sidebar there, but
sidebar.
We both had our own moment.
Kameshi horror stories.
Yeah. I should just mention nowhere near what went on, by the way. It's just sort of a little anecdote. So.
Yes. Close encounters of the weird kind.
Yeah.
The trial is just... there is a valid point to be made that the defense attorney did her job poking holes in the story. I mean, granted, time is no friend to memory, and... it seems a bit weird to focus on, to say that the credibility of these women, that it's in doubt that what happened, that what they said happened is because they can't remember the exact color of the car Kameshi drove. That's ludicrous to me.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember who it was, but somebody online pointed out, I think it was somebody who wrote for the Star. is like having your curtains open in your house, an invitation to someone to come rob you. And that's the way that this was kind of being phrased. In the meantime, not to harp on the media angle, but this entire situation was horribly covered because you had a lot of people in the courtroom who weren't used to reporting in the courtroom, posting details that they should not have been posting, things that identified witnesses who were not supposed to be identified.
And this is all coming out on Twitter mostly, right?
Mostly on Twitter, and of course it's getting retweeted and refed. And
The judge could say, shut her down. Like, you can't do that, right? The judge could say, get those devices down. I don't want you doing anything in this courtroom. Could he not?
Theoretically, I suppose.
I don't see why not. I mean, I know there was a point where cell phones...
wasn't gonna happen.
No, but there was a point where devices weren't allowed, and now they're just kind of tacitly allowed, right? But
I only know from my own limited court reporting experience that
you tweeted the whole time, didn't you?
At the Sona?
Yeah.
Well, the days I was there, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like... Yeah.
But the first day, the lawyers and the judge had it out there's people in the courtroom who are going to be tweeting out details, how copacetic is this? So I don't know if that happened in this instance, but it probably should have, especially given the subject matter and the charges and the fact that only one of these three women was known, and that's because she made herself known. Right, and that's Lucy de Couture, who's the Trailer Park Boys actress.
And they've actually revealed who the fourth potential witness was going to be.
Again, because someone outed her.
Oh, is that? Yeah.
It was Sarah Dunsworth, who was also on the Trailer Park Boys.
And they were playing some sort of weird interview with Kameshi and them, and you're supposed to listen for Kameshi's tone, and it's just, I don't know. Let the judge decide, I guess. But yeah, I think part of not having Kameshi testify is that I believe just due to the nature of his character for the Facebook letter, infamous now, as any reflection, he'd really put his foot in it. I don't think he would be a credible witness, to be honest. You're not compelled to testify against yourself, obviously.
No.
And they've held that back. But, there are times when that happens. And I think it would just, social media, among other things, would just explode because, I don't know, I don't think he would do himself any favors by going on the stand, and that's why it hasn't happened.
Even before the full length of breadth of what this was about, people were shocked by that letter. They were shocked by it.
It was so
not just
creepy things on Facebook.
It's
up there, yeah.
Not just the details of it, but the
tone.
Fact that he would do that, that if somewhere in his head or somewhere he got advice that said, this is a good idea to air your dirty laundry in advance of even dirtier laundry being announced.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Kevin Donovan and Jesse Brown, gave CBC a chance to comment, gave Kameshi a chance to comment. Both refused before this eventually did go to print.
And now CBC is giving it all kinds of coverage. It's a top story on the National every night.
Oh, watch the National.
No. I'm a bit old school, right? So tonight on the National.
I do enjoy the National on occasion.
Yeah.
Enjoy is a strong word. I want to read something Charlie Angus posted on Facebook that I thought find really interesting. NDP MP Charlie Angus. And he says, I have known Gian Kameshi casually for 25 plus years. What did I learn from the trial? Number one, that a woman who remembers being beaten is not considered credible because she didn't know the make of his car.
Hmm.
Two, that Famous people can afford lawyers known as, quote, Hannibal Lecter, unquote, for their ability to take sexual assault witnesses apart. Three, that Gian won't bother to refute any of the charges because some law expert says there are many reasons why an accused elects not to call evidence. One of them is that the complainants have been destroyed in cross-examination. Number four, that Gian flourished as a predator in what should have been the safest organization in the country and that the legal system continues to fail women. And five, that nobody close to Gian even pretends he is innocent, and somehow this isn't an issue. The women are.
That's harsh, but
yeah,
probably fairly accurate. Interesting, Angus chiming in. That's I don't know. I guess he's musician as well, and probably traveled in certain circles.
No,
so
true.
That may be the connection. I don't know.
It could be.
I do remember the not L'Etranger, whatever his band was after that. Grievous Angels. There you go.
Well, you're more musically inclined.
I was there, man. I was there in the day, man.
You got hassled.
I got hassled like a
busker.
Yeah.
So you'll always have that.
But I was never a player. I was just a guy wanting pizza.
Yeah. But, I mean, there was someone, to quote another actual law expert, Constance Blackhouse, who is a law professor at the University of Ottawa. She said the trial was like back in the 19th century when a woman had to convince court that you're blameless in order for this, in order to make the point stick. So, I mean, that's really sad on reflection.
I'll just say I better not bump into him on Bloor Street. Could be a problem.
Jeez. Do you think he's going to be
walking
down
Bloor Street?
Is that a threat?
I don't know.
Well,
he seems to just not give a... Anyway.
You think he's going to be walking unsupervised in Toronto anytime soon?
Oh, well, not anytime soon, but...
Anyway.
Yeah, we better call the time on that one.
Yeah, before we get into too much trouble.
Before I have blow a blood vessel.
Anyway, on Tuesday here in Guelph, and this is part of our challenge to ourselves to take a segment in our show to cover Guelph stuff now. There was a workshop on Tuesday. There were two workshops. They were both about affordable housing in Guelph. And they were very interesting, if only because, you know, it framed the housing problems or issues, not so much problems.
There's problems. Yeah, but no, I know what you mean. Yeah. There's definitely problems.
Depends on your point of view.
Yeah.
There was a lot of, like, nomenclature in terms of, you know, what sort of housing this is, what kind of sort of housing that is. One of the things I took away from it is that I think a lot of – I went to the early one in the afternoon, and so – but there were still – pretty good crowd. There's about 25 people there and all. The thing that struck me was, first of all, a lot of people may not understand what affordable housing is. That there's a difference between affordable housing and social housing or accessible housing.
Mm-hmm.
Affordable housing isn't like we're going to make a house and it's going to be super cheap. It's like You want to, there's a formula to it where the province sets a measurement of what constitutes a low to moderate income and what you should be able to afford as housing, because there's another formula. 30% of your income, your household income, should go to your housing. So
whether rental or own or whatever your mortgage.
There's one for rental and then there's one for ownership. Yeah, so for rental, it's about, you know, they look at $23,000 to $46,000 as low to moderate, and for a rent of, you know, between $950 and $1,150, and for ownership, it's like $46,000 to $89,000 is the moderate low to moderate mark. For buying a house at $294,000, I believe.
Yeah, that's the benchmark, eh? That's really hard to believe.
Yeah,
that it's gone that out. It's almost $300,000, obviously.
That's affordable housing.
Yeah, that's affordable housing
in Guelph. Yeah,
that's phenomenal. So much has changed since. Well, again, another anecdote. When I got into the market, we bought our place, which was a complete dump, for $100,000. That wasn't that long ago.
No, it
15,
wasn't.
16
no.
years ago, you could buy a fixer upper. Seems there are no fixer uppers left anymore, due to just the way things are going. And my particular neighborhood, which is the ward, respect to the people in the ward listening tonight, has become a bit of a flip central. There's been a lot of demolitions and infill homes. And there's been some interesting houses going in terms of I would call them Toronto style, not to be anti-Toronto by any means, but some of the infill has been curious as to, you know, you're so used to a vision of the ward, and then the infill is just all over the place in terms of these, I wouldn't even call it studio. I'm thinking particularly about the two across from Tytler. Not, I guess we don't need to pick apart types of houses. It's just that people that I know from the ward generally have known over the years could not afford to live there now. And it was considered one of the cheaper parts of town.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could buy a beater. I mean, we bought our house on minimum wage. That's, you know, those days are gone. Got in just in time. And now it's through the roof. It seems the waiting list is province-wide. Is it 168,000 households? It's massive. Mm. Like, there's that, and that's households. That's not just people. So multiply that by about three or four. That's who's waiting. Some of these lists, four-year waiting list. And it seems the largest group is either single adults or couples. Seniors are on that too. They're like 30% of the list.
The problem in Guelph has been the single units, bachelor mm-hmm. or one bedroom apartments.
Yep. Which used to be common.
Yeah, there's no stock for that in Guelph, basically.
No, and considering what's being built, like Solstice, which is the new, they'll consider those new rental units, but they're not going to the general public. They're going to students.
And student housing isn't a metric measured.
It's off the grid that they talk about at the meeting?
Well, there's different.
It's temporary.
There's two types of rentals. There's a primary rental market and there's a secondary rental market. The city only measures the primary market. So if I were to build an apartment building or a townhouse complex that was going to be all rent, that's mm-hmm. a primary. But if I bought a couple of houses on Waterloo Avenue, for example.
And put four people in them?
And yeah. That's secondary, and the city doesn't measure secondary. But you know, where do a lot of students end up?
Oh, really? So the let's call it the slumlords then, or whomever.
Like, well, if you're home, not all slum.
No. Okay, let's just say you own the house, but you don't live in it, and people rent.
Yeah,
that's considered secondary.
Yeah,
I had no idea. This is a very interesting meeting you're at there.
Yeah.
So, just as an aside, is it on Politico yet?
There's a story on Politico, and then the woman that ran it, she's a senior policy planner, Joan Jelaine. I have a 15-minute or so interview with her for tomorrow's Guelph Politico.
Might as well give folks the link since we're talking about it.
Oh, Guelph Politico.
Yes.
Blogspot.ca, yeah.
Go visit it. It's been in action since, what, 08, right?
Yeah.
10th anniversary coming. We're going to celebrate with hamburgers.
But well, that's another. That's still a couple of years
so away. The impression I'm getting from this, and somebody yeah. who wasn't able to attend the meeting but really, really wanted to, but I couldn't do it, is that because this is high on my radar too. It seems that the province is also chiming in. Of course, the province being responsible for the municipalities, and there's this report, probably another report, come out called A Place to Call Home. That's sort of a bit of a breakdown. You should check it out, folks. If you're looking for more info, Google A Place to Call Home, which I think was also a Hallmark movie of the week. But it's, you know, put in A Place to Call Home, Ontario.
Geez,
and housing. Yeah, it's one of those names, right? But something they had said in it, they were breaking down particular groups, like I had mentioned before, but also, you know, youth, Indigenous, people who are chronically homeless. Race is also a factor. I'm not sure if that came up at the meeting. But they specifically said, and they say stuff like this all the time, that we want to end homelessness in 10 years.
Right.
You know, what are the odds? Can you see, was there any – what was the over – like the projection at the meeting? What was the overall tone in terms of – what is Guelph going to do to solve this? From what I read from that other report was that the plan is to just go private. It's like, okay, it's going to be private. The city will just sort of maintain it and say, but it's all going to be private. I didn't hear anything about cooperatives, anything about charities getting involved or any alternative models, which seem to work elsewhere. It's just like, it's just going to be private, but we want more affordable housing. Is that fairly accurate or...?
No, because the point of the workshop was to get public feedback, and a lot of the public feedback was for stuff like co-ops and land banks.
Yeah, because I did the online one, and the first thing I said was co-op.
Yeah, and like social mortgages and things like that.
Yeah,
like to
great ideas that'll
some community. But yeah, a lot of community driven and motivated ideas. Yeah, it's. I'm not sure what it'll come back looking like because I think, first of all, just looking at the real estate market, right, you're talking about a very hot and active market that mm-hmm. is going in no direction but up. And how do you quantify? And the flip side of it is, how do you quantify affordable when you're saying, you know, a house, an affordable house is almost $300,000. In order to achieve that, your total household income has to be upwards of $89,000. I mean, that's this always kind of strikes me. These numbers sound like a fortune to a lot of people out there.
It's a fortune. I would say that that's a fortune to most people in Guelph. Yeah, I couldn't put a percentage on that because I'm just sort of freewheeling here. But the people that I know, $300,000 is a lot of money. And I'm talking about across the board too, everything from, let's say, students or people just off being students to working people. I can't see that. I don't think I could afford that.
Well, somebody made the point last night at the Ward 1 town hall, and they said, like, you know, we're still making Guelph wages. His point was, like, the price of everything's going up, but they're still making Guelph wages, and things are sort of, you know, going up to towards Toronto pricing. We're not there yet here with the housing prices that, you know, sometimes seven figures depending on where you are in Toronto.
Oh, yeah.
But the day is coming. There are certainly some houses like way down in the McMansion area, you know, south of Clare, before Aberfoyle, that you're talking about houses upwards of getting close to $750,000.
Someone, Audrey Meadows.
Right.
Something like that. Not to name drop, but I drive past it quite a bit coming up Victoria Road.
Yeah, exactly. But
McMansions, I like that.
Well,
sorry, Audrey Meadows people. you're probably not listening anyway. But
well, don't be so sure.
If you are, buzz us. We'd love to know.
Ring us from your McMansion. Mm-hmm. Anyway, there was a sense, though. There was somebody who actually walked out like 5 minutes in of the.
I know her. The workshop. Was it a woman?
Yeah.
I think I know who that is.
Yeah, but she wanted to talk about affordable housing, and or not affordable, but like social housing and getting people off the street. And that's kind of...
Well, that's what people think when they think affordable housing.
Exactly.
That's what I thought, too.
And that's why this was so informative to me, was affordable housing doesn't mean, you know, here's a... pay a dollar, get your house. It means like something more appropriate to the pricing, if you can call $300,000 appropriate.
Yeah, and that's just the benchmark. I mean, I'm sure there's variables in there, too, where they say, well, you know, there's housing at this price. You know, this, it's probably a scale, right, in terms
right.
of – yeah, but, yeah, if that's the benchmark, then that's too damn high.
But, I mean, there is a bailiwick of problems with housing. And Guelph has a vacancy rate from August – the number from August 2015 was 0.6%. A healthy vacancy rate is supposed to be 3%. Now, according to some of the more recent numbers, maybe closer to 1.2%, and that's because there's new units coming online. But again, we're like 5 years. We haven't had new apartment building go up in 5 years.
Yeah, no one's building apartments anymore. It's all about the condo, right?
Well, there's a building going up in Imperial Elmira.
But that's in a proper apartment?
Yeah.
Is it the old-fashioned kind of?
Yeah.
Hmm.
But you're right.
How many units did they say?
I don't know off the top of my head.
It's the problem. It's all skewed towards developers, condo.
But it's not going to be that many units. It's like 4 or 5 stories.
Yeah.
If
it's an investment. They're hoping.
I go past there all the time, but I've never counted.
I think I know the one.
Stories. But yeah, it's this is the first apartment building in Guelph in 5 years, and it's probably still, you know, maybe 6 months away from completion. And then, you know, who knows what's going on after that. It's condos.
Yeah, which isn't affordable. They're just hoping people will sell up and move into them or come, you know, bail from Toronto and pay a little less for one and take the GO train every day to their Toronto job so they can pay for the condo.
Well, that seems like a good place to leave it at. Anyway, we're going to take a break. And
I'm just getting rolling, my man.
And come back with some more discussion. You are listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
You're listening to CFRU
93.3 in Guelph, Ontario.
Yeah, azadi hai ولاتمن آزاد ببن دن آلای کیتیه وایه بی شیار دبن تو هشای آزادیه ولاتمن آزاد ببن دن آلای کیتیه وایه بی شیار دبن جدا بون گلکی زوره دست برادی نبرد رکا آزادی ندورد دشمنی نکرد
And if you're wondering, that was some random Kurdish music that we found online. We were actually looking for something in the archives that was Kurdish-based, so we thought we'd play a little bit of that to lead into our next guest. It's untitled or anything. I have no idea. It's just some folk musicians. I really have no idea who that was. So,
yes.
That's probably the worst sort of outline of a song ever, but I'll find out.
Yeah, we'd like to give them credit.
Yeah, of course you would. It just says Kurdish music, so there you go.
It's good to know that Google still pays off in vague requests.
We normally play CDs, yeah, but anyway.
Yeah. Joining us on the phone is Robert Somerville. He is a Canadian Forces veteran. He served in Afghanistan with Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry C Company out of Edmonton. And he knows what's going on in Syria in the fight against ISIS because he's been there fighting alongside Kurdish forces in the fight to take back Syria from ISIS and Assad and the terrible civil war that's been going on there. And he is joining us on the phone. Robert, are you there? Oh, did we lose him?
I think we might have.
Oh. Anyway, perhaps while we're trying to sort out the technical, we'll just talk about what happened this week in Ottawa. As you know, the new Liberal government's been developing a strategy to deal with the ISIS threat, the new Canadian strategy. Of course, the previous government under Stephen Harper dedicated 6 fighter jets plus some accessory forces to fight ISIS in Iraq and Syria. Justin Trudeau promised to bring the fighter jets home in the October campaign.
I think we might have him now. Robert, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry about that. We had a slight glitch there, but you're with us now. So, great.
Excellent.
Sorry about that.
No worries.
Thanks for joining us. So, to begin with, perhaps you can tell us a little bit about your decision to, because you went as under your own initiative to Syria to fight ISIS alongside the Kurdish forces there, and you're not alone in that. I think the number I saw was there's about 20 other Canadians who have gone over. So in terms of your own decision to go overseas and fight ISIS, what went into that?
I think just a lot of things over the last 4 years that have happened around the world. Various terrorist attacks happening. The one that comes mostly to mind is the attacks in Pakistan at the school where 123 children were killed. Just those kind of things just kind of give me the inspiration. And fighting with the YPG and YPJ it was the most clear-cut place to go. So that's where I went.
Yeah, because we've spoken about it in the past, and it's a very complex situation in terms of the parties. And I know it's you know, we've tried to sort of outline it to people, but it's very confusing. I was just wondering from was it difficult for you to get to the front? Because you hear about people going on this journey and just sort of randomly getting in contact with people. Was that in itself? I realize your journey home was another story as well. But in terms of actually getting to the front, was that pretty clear cut what you had to do or where you had to go?
Yeah. I mean, it was much easier getting in than getting out, really. You just fly into Iraq and you get smuggled across the border.
Oh, so
Once you get a hold of the right people, then it's just smooth sailing all the way there.
Well, what can you tell us about in terms of the fight? I mean, we obviously hear things through the media here and the things that the government tells us through their own efforts in terms of fighting ISIS. But if there's something you could tell Canadians about fighting ISIS and the other groups in Syria fighting ISIS that they don't know, what would that be?
I think probably the biggest thing would be that a lot of people, I think, in the West are a little... they don't know why it's taking so long. They think that we have such overwhelming power, we should be able to roll through them. Just the reality on the ground is you're facing an enemy that is quite willing to die to just slow you down a day. So it takes a long, long time to clear every single village and secure the area that you have and the roads and everything. So it's a very, very slow-going operation. And that's why it's probably taken so long. But, I mean, they are moving forward. I mean, it's just going to be a long, slow grind.
Mm-hmm. Because I think you described it as 90% boredom and 10% action. I was wondering if you've obviously heard about the cancellation of the airstrikes, at least the Canadian ones, which I think it sounds like it was like 1% to 2% of the actual bombing itself. From your view and your perspective, as somebody who's been there, do airstrikes, and I mean as a blanket thing, not just the Canadian ones, were the airstrikes helpful to the Kurds, YPG, or the Peshmerga, or people that are fighting ISIS? Did they actually do the job?
They're the only thing that are saving the situation. Without the airstrikes, the Kurds in Syria would have been wiped out, and the Peshmerga would have been pushed back into the mountains. Without the airstrikes, everything would have been... ISIS would have taken it all.
So I take it the people on the ground, it's like they don't really care where the airstrikes come from, just as long as they're hitting ISIS full bore.
No, I don't think there's...
Because that's the thing, there just seems to be so many parties bombing, and we said a couple of weeks ago that it sounds like the U.S. have run out of bombs. That's how much is going into this, and yet, you know, they just keep going, so...
Yeah, to them, it's all. I mean, it's not Dutch, it's not French, it's not German. It's all United States. They call the bombs Obamas.
Oh, really?
So, I mean, to them, it's all the United States. I mean, they might know, and you know, some people might know that you know Canada participated a little bit, but generally, it's all America to them. So, the Kurds on the ground don't really take those things into account. I think people were more concerned about how international partners feel about us getting out or not doing it or doing it, from what I understand. But the Kurds, they don't really care. They're not cognizant of us being involved in that way.
Well, for better or worse, the airstrikes, at least on Canada's part, have been canceled. I'm wondering what your thoughts might be if you are aware of the plan that was announced Monday by the Prime Minister and his team. If you think that is going to be helpful to the people on the ground fighting ISIS, or is it not going to help at all, or what are your thoughts?
I think the money that's going to go into reconstruction is great. I mean, we should give as much as we can. Spend it wisely, of course, but give as much as we can. The problem with that is that most of the ground that money needs to go to is in ISIS hands. So, I mean, it's not going to get there until we actually push them out of Iraq and Syria.
Right.
So that stuff can only really start bearing fruit in the next 5 years, maybe. The training stuff, I mean, it's moot. The Kurds don't need training. So I don't see what training, increasing the training people, is how it's going to help the situation.
Mm-hmm.
So that I don't think it's a non-issue. It's a way to look like you're doing stuff without actually doing stuff.
So is the hope on the ground then that eventually some forces, and no idea who, would sort of come to their senses and just sort of fight alongside the YPG or the, I mean, I guess we're seeing a bit of that, but in terms of, you know, is there a hope on the ground that other than just sort of the internationals that have come and joined the fight, that a force would be assembled from somewhere, you know, whether a particular nation or if, you know, and not a militia of some sort was raised and more bodies were put on the ground? Or is it also a lack of equipment? Because I've heard a bit of that, too, in terms of the, you know, what's being used to actually go at ISIS isn't necessarily, I guess there's been some help from America and others. But it sounds like it's a case of, and I was reading a bit too about your sort of, you know, food shortages and things like that. There just seems to be a lack of not only resources, but of bodies. Now, would both those things be helpful, or is what's your view on that?
I think the Pesh probably has the Peshmerga probably have enough weapons and equipment to do everything that they need to. They've already taken every bit of territory that they had before the war started. Mm. So in their minds, they can just sit on their hands at this point. The international community wants them to take Mosul. They don't want to take it because they know they're not going to get to keep it if they do. Mm. So, I mean, we're probably going to have to bribe them in some way to get them to take the city. But equipment-wise, I think they're fine. The YPG, YPJ, they need weapons because mostly they need ammunition, because when we go on operation with them, I mean, in 3 weeks, you're running out of ammo and you're still fighting. You're in a very bad scene if you can't get resupplied that way. And we did run out of food quite a few times near the end of it. Logistics, as the line gets pushed forward, you know, the roads are still not really cleared, so it's hard and hard to get food out. And, you know, the line spreads out, you need more food, so you run out of food with them. So they need help in those ways, in logistical ways. I think the West is reluctant to give it to them.
Hmm. And do you think that's mostly because of their political philosophy, or just because they're, I wouldn't say a rogue element, but sort of not really aligned with anybody?
No, it's because, I would say it's because their ideological, you know, bent with the PKK, but that's not why the West doesn't like them. The fact that they're a little bit socialist and they believe in social democracy and all the other stuff that ideology has, which is quite benign, really, has nothing to do with that. It has everything to do with the PKK and Turkey. Turkey doesn't want supplies going to the YPG and the YPJ just because they don't want it, you know.
Mm. And if I got it right, there were Turkish... you validate this, is that there have been Turkish assaults on PKK targets quite a bit?
In Iraq, yeah. I mean, they're attacking in the cities. They're basically besieging cities in Turkey that have
a Kurdish population. Kurdish.
Mm. Yeah, and putting in curfews, and they're fighting in the streets with, like, some of the youth groups. In Syria, not so much. They've shelled a couple times, but that's about it. They actually invaded Iraq for like a week in the summer. Yeah.
Didn't hear much reporting on that. Anyway, to wrap up, you mentioned that in facing ISIS doesn't care about, you know, ISIS forces, I should say, don't care about dying, even if it just slows you down by a day. And from, I'm not a military expert by any means, but it does sound like these guys don't have a kind of long-term plan in mind. It's all about, can we win the day? Can we win this battle? Is that a fair assessment?
I think they have a long-term plan, but it's crazy because they're crazy. They want to take over the world. I can't analyze ISIS. I just think they're out of their minds. I don't want to swear.
Right.
They're crazy. You know, they are just out there. I mean, there's no explanation for it.
But, and having said that, though, I mean, for some politicians here in the West, they're building up ISIS as a boogeyman. But just from talking to you and your experiences, they do sound beatable. So what would it take, do you think?
You just need two elements. You need a ground force on the ground that is willing to take casualties and to hold ground. Mm-hmm. And you need air support. With those two things, you can push them back. The problem in Iraq, the Sunni areas, is you do not have a force there that is willing to take casualties against these guys. So it doesn't matter how many airstrikes you have no one on the ground who's willing to take it and hold it and push forward. It's just not going to get done. Mm-hmm. And that's why we've seen the Kurds and the Peshmerga take back all their land, and the Shias do the same in the south, and then the Kurds in Syria do it as well. I mean, the Syrian Kurdish groups have taken huge amounts of land mm-hmm. in the last year, and those guys were incredibly ill-equipped, and they're basically starting from scratch. I mean, it's a group that's only about 5 years old or so. Wow. So very inexperienced, but they managed to take over, you know, quite a bit of land.
Well, Robert, we appreciate your point of view and your expertise, and we're glad you made it out safe, and we're also glad you're able to join us today on our show. So thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, no worries. Thank you.
Thanks.
And that was Robert Somerville, a Canadian Forces veteran and a veteran in the war on ISIS, fighting firsthand in Iraq and Syria. And we appreciate his time today. And since we were talking so much about politics, we're going to wrap up briefly, because we talked about the Iowa caucuses last week, and that was the first big vote in the U.S. presidential election this year. New Hampshire happened on Tuesday. And while the Iowa story was one of kind of surprise about who won and who came in second and who came in third, the New Hampshire one was sort of preordained. Donald Trump won handily on the Republican side. Bernie Sanders won handily on the Democratic side.
It was a clobbering for Sanders.
It was, yeah. It was
60%, 59%,
60, 30. Yeah, it was.
That's pretty big.
But you know what's weird is they get the same number of delegates out mm-hmm. of him and Hillary Clinton. They both get 8 delegates each, which is – no, 15 delegates each, which is weird. There's 8 superdelegates that have to be allotted.
The superdelegates seem to be the ones that are going to carry the day. I don't know.
But, I mean, they're basically tied, Bernie and, mm-hmm. and Hillary, in terms of the number of delegates they have so far, which is one of the many oddities of American politics.
It's incredible, really, this system they have. Coming up in second place, though, which was a bit of a surprise, Kasich, John Kasich.
Yeah. Who's being described as the moderate.
He seems like the only guy that isn't a complete, sorry, in my view, nut job as far as Republicans go. And, yeah, that's just me talking, folks, because, you know, you break it down, it's like, and Carson was dead last, is that right?
Yeah.
But he's still in the game, it seems. But
he's holding on, yeah.
Fiorino and Chris Christie have said, called it a day.
Yeah.
Usually people start to get, you know, shake loose by New Hampshire, and I'm sure by Super Tuesday, anybody that's just sort of in by a hair will be gone. Which is, when is Super Tuesday again? March something?
It's March the 1st.
Sweeps. Oh, so soon enough. 3 weeks.
Well, it is a 5-person race now. It's even though Carson is still technically in it, but, you know, Carson's results have been negligible in the 2 votes so far. But, I mean, he does have his base of support, which is sort of why he's hanging on. It's basically Trump, Kasich, Cruz, Bush, and Rubio. Kasich, he survived New Hampshire and got a surprise second place, but like you said, he's the moderate here.
Yeah.
Even though he's like
banker or something, is he like Lehman Brothers? Like, he's not exactly
in Ohio today. Like, he's just signed stringent new anti-abortion measures, and he's like,
so he's humming the tune then.
Yeah, he's been fighting the same fight Scott Walker's been fighting with, like, public service unions, and, you know, he's not that moderate. Once you kind of get into the nitty gritty, he sounds like a stark raving liberal when he's on stage next to all those other guys. But yeah, it's
he's not shooting from the hip.
But I mean,
Donald, I shoot from the hip, Trump. That should be a slogan.
Donald, I will do worse than waterboarding Trump.
Oh jeez.
I despite myself, I watched that debate from beginning to end. Oh. The Republican one on Saturday.
Did you have any cocktails nearby or something? This would take for me. Like, or sedatives, one or the other.
It's like this beautiful car wreck that you can't stop watching. Oh.
It keeps on giving. That's what we keep talking about it. So, you know.
From the, like, they totally fumbled, like, the introduction with, like, Ben Carson.
Oh, so he wouldn't move. That's what I saw that somewhere.
It's like, yeah, it's. And then they forgot to call out John Kasich. And then it goes.
Why is it all kind of football? Like, you know, it's like number 7, Donald Trump.
Yeah, I don't know what it was. It was just this bizarre thing, and
maybe they knew people would mess it up.
And then,
I saw Bush walking by him. He's like, "Oh, okay, guys, you can stand here."
I'm out. I am honestly feeling sorry for Jeb Bush, because
I think he got a bit of a raw deal.
Not only is he
not like any of the Republicans, but
well, not only is he having to, like, whip out George on the campaign and in
that's right. I heard the commercial. Yeah, Jeb's a good guy.
But Samantha Bee started her show this week, and it had this like merciless Werner Herzog parody of covering Trump in New Hampshire. It is the funniest.
Is that the one with Johnny Depp in it? Or is that another thing?
That was another thing. The Bush thing.
I'm so glad Samantha
Bee show
has a show, by the way. But anyway, yeah,
it is hilarious.
I have to check it out.
It is a hilarious show. At least the first episode was hilarious, and the Bush thing was like,
I'm going to track it down then.
Yeah, it was. It's on YouTube and everything. The Johnny Depp thing is the Funny or Die made a Art of the Deal movie trailer, shot 80s style,
excellent.
And Johnny Depp's Donald Trump.
See that.
And it's a pretty good impersonation, I must admit.
For sure. And, of course, there was a moment there where Trump sort of dragged it all into the toilet with his, we won't say it on the air, but calling Ted Cruz another name for a small kitty cat.
No, he didn't say it. He said, she said it. I didn't say it.
You're going to get in trouble.
And then he repeated.
You're not going to be able to talk again.
That's classic. That's classic Trump, right? That was, I forget what circumstance that happened earlier where somebody shouted out
heckler,
something.
Yeah.
And then he's like, they said it. They said this, not me.
I didn't say it. I'm just going to repeat it.
And then
not very presidential kind of behavior, actually, at all.
Well, the thing that slays me was the waterboarding thing. Like 16 years later, and he gets up on stage and it's just like, I'm going to do waterboarding and a lot worse. And then
does he even read media or anything anymore? Is he like is he such a throwback that it's like,
I don't know. But his son Eric comes out a couple of days later and he's like, waterboarding? We used to do that in fraternity hazing. Come on.
Ugh across the board.
Considering some of the stuff you hear about fraternity hazing,
yes.
I don't think you want
like people dying. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, do these people listen to themselves?
No, I don't think they do. It's just that whole what Neil Diamond was talking about, money talks, right? It's like, whoa. Yeah, I don't know. And back to the sort of whole primary scenario, it's really weird in that New Hampshire, doesn't matter what party you belong to, you can vote for anybody. Have I got that right?
Like, if you're a registered independent,
you can vote
in either.
So there's this body of people that actually exceed both Democrats and Republicans. It's something like 400,000 people who can just go whatever way.
Well, that's why people are looking at this with a degree of not skepticism, but a degree of like, don't read too much into this, because Bernie's victory, Bernie Sanders' victory. I talk about him like I know him.
Well, he is Bernie. He is Bernie.
You know, his 60% victory, right, is predicated on the fact that he's, you know, from the area.
He's from the area.
That base of independent support going into South Carolina and Nevada, where the African Americans and Latinos are, those aren't necessarily his people, though he was sort of schmoozing Al Sharpton the other day.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to be to his advantage so much as it's going to be to Clinton's advantage. Meanwhile, same as Trump. Trump is polling incredibly well with independents, so you see that vote coming up. But now he's going into South Carolina, where the evangelicals come back into play, and that's going to advantage particularly Cruz and Rubio.
Yeah. Yeah, Sanders got Big Mike on his side, right? So I don't know if that'll help, right?
Sanders does have Killer Mike.
Killer Mike. Did I say Big Mike? Yeah. Killer Mike? I got my mics mixed up, sorry.
He's Killer Mike, yeah.
Killer Mike.
What I found fascinating about the Bernie vote was he crushed it in women, all categories of women, all age groups of women.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think that's the Clinton feed. It's going, well, he's no good with women, and the, you know, the black people don't like him, whatever. It's like, I think they're just saying stuff at this point.
Well,
Hillary's she has to be a little bit nervous, right?
Oh, she has to be.
Now, mind you, Clinton the first didn't win New Hampshire.
No.
And went on. And neither did Obama, right?
Obama, yes, Hillary won New Hampshire in 2008.
Oh, she did?
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. So
he won. Obama won Ohio and South Carolina, but he didn't win
New Hampshire. So it's not a bellwether, I guess.
Not necessarily.
But it is, I guess, because it's first. We focus on it.
Huh. Yeah, but we're gonna probably revisit that. Probably not again until Super Tuesday. There's a couple of primaries in between, but we'll see how that.
Yeah, somebody complains. Why are you guys talking about American politics?
We can't predict the news.
No.
But you can follow it all week long on opensourcesguelph.com or our Facebook page, Open Sources Newswire, at @OS_Guelph. And then, of course, you can listen to this episode again along with other episodes of Guelph Politicast Sorry, open source is Guelph on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean. I get my things backwards sometimes. I am at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter and guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on everything, Facebook, Twitter, Google me. There's things out there.
Yeah, you can find them pretty easy. Anyway.
For now.
until Xiog comes for them. Anyway, DJ Sounds Good to Me is going to be here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back here next week with more open sources, Thursdays at 5 p.m. And until then, have a good week.